show that we get recons of attendance, let's say for up to the end of October, if we can get that on the 10th of November for everyone, 10th on, you know, by the 10th, as it were, you know. And then members can check that because, you know, under the new rules, certain things apply. Are we all on board with that? And if mistakes have been made, please let Mr. Whittington, you all know Mr. Whittington, just ask him to check the register or whatever, and I will also do something about it. That's the first thing. The next thing are the, and I really would like to welcome you, Commissioner. I'm sure it is now Commissioner, not, or is it, it can't be still DDG, because there's an acting DDG, am I right? You, but you're very welcome in, with this new hat, which I know as the gestation took place under yourself, that it's in the right hands with you and your colleague, etc., whom I said one sees people, but you don't often remember their names, etc., and that is Miss Nokwala Boy. Boy, hey, thank you. Operations. And we know that Mr. Kumkani, Investigations and Enforcement, I see, I never know if one is achieving, what is the word, fame or notoriety. I think in this committee we achieve fame. All right. And Mr. Liso Setu, yes, Chief Director, SEZ and Economic Transformation. You are all welcome. And just to look at the apologies here, let's adopt the agenda first. Do we have a quorum? We do. Can we please have someone propose the adoption of the agenda? Thank you, Honourable Mantashe, seconded by the Honourable Williams. Now, we are on track. It is my intention to try and finish today at 12:30, all right? The apologies are noted from Mr. The Honourable Esterhazen, Family Responsibility Leave, the Honourable MacPherson, Party Business. Can you please check Mr. Medima about Mr. Shivambu's attendance? He is a full member, and we need to ensure, even though he's the senior whip of his party, that we do get the letter, all right? Thank you. So that being in order, I want to welcome the Honourable Jitlangoma Mabasa, who I understand, I'm sure I'm correct, you are the whip of small business. Am I right? Your favourite mandate, as we know from this committee. Thank you for your presence just while we're doing the minutes. And indeed, it is agreed that the Honourable Williams will leave at about 9:20 to assist you with your quorum, etc. Thank you. Members, on that note, let's take out the minutes. The minutes here. These are the 13th of September. May I say that these, the style in which these minutes are done will change in discussions with administration, but legally they are the minutes, but we're going to synthesize them more. Is that understood? Right. So you have everyone there. Can you check the attendance register, which on one occasion was incorrect, but I'm sure now we're all okay. Yep. Right. And then the next thing is the notice here, Shivambu. It may be useful, both the portfolio committee secretaries, when someone's absent on more than one occasion, they may, especially with there's so much work now, have forgotten you actually need to put it in writing, notwithstanding that it's a valid apology. Please, will one of you call the Honourable Shivambu just to point out this because we are obliged to mark him absent without a written apology. Right, the opening, that's the auditor was here that day. That was a very important meeting, too. So you see, it's in the method of questions or comments, which will change. That was page 2. I hope everyone's concentrating. Page 3. You know, everything is subject to human error. And you're going to be adopting this. Page 3. You've seen this before, but it needed cleaning up. Right? Which reminds me, that steel issue. Page 4. Page 5. I just wanted to check with someone. I think you still have a very close relationship within the department itself, Ms. Ntuli, Commissioner. As I recall, well, there is Ms. Naidu here as well. We noted here that there are now 14 public entities. I thought it was 13 with one to come. Am I correct there, Ms. Naidu?
Chair, there's 13 entities. The trust is the fund, the and then there's the there's another body that's going to be created.
About the NPZ advisory body.
It's not an entity, Ms. Robson.
A pardon?
It's not an entity. It's a, okay. An advisory body.
Apologise. That's I corrected to this. Can we just correct this to 13? 13. Is that in order? Right. And then we did adjourn. Okay. Can we have someone who actually applied their minds to propose adoption? Honourable Williams, seconded by Honourable Mantash. We'd like some of you practicing the Wild West, you know, sort of sharper on the draw. Okay. Then we have, that was that. We have the 20th, right. The 20th, which was yesterday. Oh, September. Yes, who was present? We had quite a full house, but we also had many apologies. You see, there we have Honourable Shivambu with an apology. That's what I mean. Page 1. Page 2. Someone's calling. Oh, no. Page 2. Page 3. Yes, Honourable William.
Chairperson, these minutes appear not to have page numbers.
I know.
Some advice from the Portfolio Committee Secretary on my left here, Mr. Herman. Is that a huge legal problem? Okay. It's for us, it would be extremely helpful. Now, I'm not sure if I inadvertently took them off or one of you. So let's leave that. We'll make sure in future they are there. My apologies. Right. Can we please have someone to propose adoption of these minutes on the Tuesday, the 20th September? Yes, Honourable Quernoff, seconded by the Honourable Williams. 13th of October. Now, can I please ask you, Mr. Hermans, I know you're not normally sitting here on today, but is that the last time we did this? Was there a constituency from the 20th? Okay. All right, Thursday the 13th, and please remind me to come back to that, page 1. Page 2. Just look. that was the issue. Page 2, local public procurement. Page 3. Auditor General submitted. Serious. Are we all here? Where's the problem, Honourable Colonel? What page? Okay, I'm not there yet. All right, so page 4. The chairperson. Yeah. In fact, certainly that may have been on the, when was it, the 13th, but I'm no longer, yeah, very much like the Cuban trip, this trip. Yeah, because unfortunately what is said in committee, you know, yeah, it's a record of those proceedings. But what... we'll come back to the other issues. Page 4. Are we all set? Page 4. Right. Now, on that basis, can we please have someone to propose adoption of those minutes? But just before you do that, perhaps I should just preface this with one thing. I am looking at this, and I was advised by one of our secretaries here, Mr. Hermans, that we needed to ensure that when we took even positions or whatever, we needed to have a close watch. That's why minutes are important to be done as soon as possible after, because everyone's recollection, I would hope, is clear. And there was a need for us to ensure. We started off without a quorum, remember? Then we got a co-opted DA person. Do you remember that? And we had a slight difference of opinion, which means that we're both human. You know, one of us obviously has it wrong. And I was under the impression that I could be wrong, that the Honourable Mazzoni was there when it was proposed by yourself, Honourable Williams, and seconded by the Honourable Hill Lewis. And Mr. Herman's sort of recollection was that, no, he thought that Honourable Mazzoni had left. Am I correct? So we do have to ask you, because I'm, you know, that was my own recollection. But as I say, you were also there. I'm looking to see who was there. No, I'm looking to see who was there. Fabs, Kornoff, Williams, Mantash, Hill Lewis. So, you know, when we're talking about the debt relief issue, all right? Honourable Mantash?
If my memory serves well, Chairperson, I think she left after that decision was made. So a decision was made after it was seconded by Hill Lewis.
By someone else, because I think it's a bit awkward.
I remember that Hill Lewis seconded the report, but whether he seconded that proposal, I'm in doubt. I really cannot recall that. But maybe we should ask him and let it...
Second the actual thing. That is not the question. The question was really a, what do you call it, the quorum. And I have to be frank, I am not infallible. You know what I mean? And I think I'll hear one more voice and then we'll check with the Honourable Hill Lewis. Right. Honourable Williams, and then Mr. Hermans, all right?
Chairperson, as far as I can recall, the member that came in only left after we had adopted the report. So she was in the room when the adoption took place. That's the reason she was there. Remember, Honourable Hill Lewis had to leave the meeting to go and get her. So we continued with the meeting until we had that quorum, and then we adopted that report. So it is, yeah, so it's fine.
Now, Honourable Williams, we're not talking about the report. We had no difficulty there. We were talking about the proposal on debt relief. Right. In that case, as I say, we've taken a position here at the table that we will ask Honourable Hill Lewis. Will you speak to it, please, Mr. Herman?
Members, I've listened to the recording of the proceedings of that morning. Mrs. Mazzoni left immediately after the decision to adopt the colloquium report was adopted. The discussion that subsequently followed, that there was no quorum on that issue. So I've listened to the recording. I've advised the chairperson that if there was any decision taken after she has left, it's not a decision because we did not have a quorum. So my recollection, I've listened to the recording, she left immediately after the report was adopted. So when we proceeded with the committee meeting, which we can, there was no quorum.
Yeah.
So any decision that subsequently were taken would not be a decision because we did not have a quorum.
Yeah. So you can ask the chair to do certain things, but the point procedurally stands. So as I say, I will check with Honourable Hill Lewis, but I have to acknowledge that I'm certainly not infallible, you know, and I think that those are things that we need be there. So on that basis, though, I'm going to let these hang in the balance, that ends, until we get Honourable Hill Lewis, although I have, in my experience with working with Mr. Hermans, he's always been proved right on procedural matters. Thank you. That in order then. So we won't adopt them right now. We'll wait until the Honourable Hill Lewis is here. Or are we agreed on that basis? Right. Then we put that aside, both of those, and as I said, Mr. Whittington, perhaps seen as we need our secretary's attention, you would be kind enough to call the Honourable Hill Lewis and the Honourable Albert, both of whom said they'd be here just after 9, but of course the traffic. All right. Am I correct? Fine, thank you very much. As you know, members, every committee on a Friday is under huge pressure of quorums. So at 20 past, the Honourable Williams will leave for a short while. All right? And, of course, the whip of small business. And that'll leave 4 of us, which I understand, Mr. Hermans, that when there are 4 of us, we can continue.
Yes.
Right, okay. On that note, then, let's come to some solid business of the day. Can we do that? Right. Can we please then turn to yourself, Commissioner, and you please, I understood from our colleagues in the National Council of Provinces that this was one of the best, most interesting and informative presentations they've had for a long time on the triple B double E, and you know, we've been waiting for it ever since, can't wait to get it. So over to yourself, Commissioner, and your team.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members. We must just also just express our gratitude for the opportunity to come and engage this committee. I always say it's a pleasure to come in there, so it is a pleasure. Chair, I'm going to just quickly introduce the team. As everyone is aware, the BBB Commission is a new institution. We're still in construction. Unfortunately, we were not given an opportunity to really construct and have a structure and start running. So as we were constructing this entity, we were already receiving complaints. So we had to work as we are establishing. So we're running everything parallel. So you'll recall, Chair, that the last presentation that we had with the committee was largely on the establishment, the processes that we had around stakeholder engagement, the issues that emerged from that. All of those issues are the issues that then informed our strategy and how we're going to tackle the mandate that we are having under this important piece of legislation. Chair, my name is Zodwa Ntuli, currently responsible for the BBB Commission. I have my colleagues here, Nontokozo, who is responsible for our operations, and we have Sipamandla Kumkani. Chair, you will also know Sipamandla from the credit side of things, so you'll see some familiar faces, because I had to establish a team because we started from nothing, so there's nothing that we're working from, so I had to draw from the team that I have been working with in the department to start establishing the entity. Ms. Pamandla is responsible for investigations and enforcement. And then, as you have already indicated, Chair, we have Liso Steto, who is the Chief Director, specifically responsible for the BBB policy and legislation within the department. Chair, we'll be guided by yourself. We try to put as much information on the slides, but we try to compress that into one slide. So most of the information is compressed. So we will not necessarily touch everything, but it's for the information so that if there are any questions on those issues, that we are actually able to respond to them. Chair, we're going to just start then with who we are. As I indicated, the last time we said we're establishing an entity. So we have gone through a process of developing the entity, and we have gone through the planning process. We've got our strategy, which has been approved by the minister, as well as the annual performance plan, which the minister has already approved. So although the commission has not been listed as a public entity yet, because that process is still underway, but we're already operating as an entity that is outside of government in terms of its independence, in terms of decision making and so forth. So we have prepared all of the documents that are necessary. Chair, I must apologize. I thought we'll bring you the copies of our strategy document as well as our APP, because those documents are already available, but we couldn't bring them through for some reason, but we will send them so that the committee is aware of what our strategy looks like. So our strategy was informed by what we went through in terms of the process of engaging on what exactly our mandate should be. So, you know, after going through that process, then we then defined what our mission is, what our vision is, and also what are the values that are going to drive us. So this slide is basically telling us about that. The mission of the commission basically is to facilitate the implementation of the Act. But what we are saying there, you'll see the key word being the accelerated productive implementation. Acceleration because since 2003, when the BBB legislation was passed, the country has not seen any significant progress. So we see our mandate as now assisting the country to accelerate the achievement of the objectives under the BBB legislation. So our mission emphasizes the acceleration because we need to ensure that there is real transformation, there is radical transformation in those sectors of the economy where we need black people to be empowered. But in general, transformation has been lagging in the country. It has not been moving in the pace that it should be moving. Chair, just in terms of our vision is aligned to what the vision of this country is. Largely, really, to create an inclusive economy for everyone. So our vision is aligned to that. So everything that we do as the organization would be looking at whether or not a B initiative is driving towards inclusivity. So as the commission, we will really look at those transactions, those BE deals that are taking place. If they're not advancing inclusivity and they still pursue the narrow approach to triple BEE, we will pronounce on those. So in its broad nature, triple BEE should be benefiting the country and create the inclusivity that is required. So that is our focus in terms of where we're going. And I'm not going to touch on all of our values, Chair, but I think the most critical value that we think is a value that we'll live by, in fact, and elevate on a daily basis is the zero tolerance to corruption. And we've said that this is important for us because we're dealing with a situation where the environment already is a corrupt environment. In Triple B, we deal with fronting every day. And that's corruption. Fronting is corruption. There's no other word for it. So that is why we're saying it will be zero tolerance for us. So when we're looking at matters where there is a fronting practice, we'll take a very strict approach towards that. But also internally, we want to ensure that we have the kind of officials that will actually not be susceptible to influence, not be susceptible to any improper gestures and so forth. So we want to make sure that we live by that. Chair, just in terms of the background, again, because it's important that we just give the background again, where we come from in terms of the triple B legislation. Sometimes people do forget, and we pick it up now that we're in this triple B space. We pick it up that people, when they talk about triple B, they talk about the surface, just here. So we never go to the detail of really what is this intended to do? Why is it there? And as a result, we're not able to see whether whatever we're implementing is actually going towards that direction. The 1996, our constitution in this country, when it was passed in 1996, it was deliberate that it recognized the disparities in this country, the unequal income distribution, the huge gap between the poor and the rich. Those are the things that the constitution recognized. And in Clause 9, where we speak about the right to equality, the Constitution made it clear that government must implement measures. Those measures could be measures that are legislative in nature, or they could be program-driven. But also, they could be measures that are creating an environment, even in the private sector, for equality to be achieved. But it's important that when we speak about the achievement of equality, that you need to get to a point of equity. So that means that you must redress because other people are miles away. Others were left behind because of the opportunities. So we don't need to rehash that, but it's important that every time we speak about triple BEE, it's understood within the context. So when the Constitution was adopted, some of the measures that were legislative in nature, like the Employment Equity Act, was passed, like the Triple BEE Act was passed. And all of these pieces of legislation, they were intended to bring in the level of equity that will now start putting everybody on the same footing. And it is a process. But then in terms of where we are as a country, the pace, Chair, is just not acceptable. So now the foundation for triple B legislation, it is the same type of interventions like the employment equity, except that the employment equity is directed at dealing with transforming the flaws, transforming the organizations in terms of the employees. So when we come to triple B, we're talking about now transforming the economy of the country. So now it talks about intervention in the mainstream economy. How do you facilitate entry? How to create new black businesses and so forth? So now we moved on from that. In 2003, the legislation was passed. But then it was just a framework legislation. It didn't have anything. So there wasn't any monitoring. So anybody could do what they feel is okay under the triple B legislation. In 2007, although the codes of good practice were passed, the first codes, the implementation thereof, every company just implemented it in the way that they think is right. And that lack of monitoring resulted in a whole lot of practices that emerged as a result. we saw a whole lot of fronting. Chair, when I was giving an example around some of those practices, I indicated that I think that's the problem. When something starts, we see it, but then we don't deal with it as it emerges. When fronting started, we saw companies starting to change the names of the companies from whatever company to Zodwa Inc. or Zodwa, so that then it looks a bit African, it looks a bit empowered, it looks, but then the company is not empowered. So it started with the name changes. So we started with the make-believe, and we allowed it to happen. So the make-believe happened, and government was accepting all of those new words, new names, and all of those. But then it moved on to now, when companies started now changing the directors, adding some black directors, but not necessarily wanting them, but adding them for the purpose of benefiting from contracts from government. So that's where we started seeing the emergence of now domestic workers, gardeners, who never knew that they were actually anything in companies, and then they were recorded as such. So that's when we started a frequent activity at the CPRO at a time, where companies now were adding new directors on their records, but with no intention of making these people directors. So that's how it started. So now we had people that didn't know anything about a company that were put as directors or as shareholders, and we allowed it again. It went on. But now it's taken another form. It's now more complex. Fronting is more complex now. In fact, yesterday I was sitting in a session where a company was explaining a very good employee share scheme that they have. And they actually were boasting about the, you know, the 63% black ownership. And when I asked them a question around, are those employees on that employee share scheme, are they owners or are they beneficiaries? Because that's where, again, the problem is at. People call employees, they say it's an employee share scheme, it's they own the company, but actually they don't. They're just beneficiaries, because when you resign, you walk as if you're not a shareholder. You walk with nothing. So again, now it's taking a different form, where actually fronting is becoming more sophisticated. It looks like something that is good, but it's actually just fronting at the end of the day. So we're dealing with more complex structures here. So now, all of these practices, when they emerged, they necessitated this parliament to go back to the drawing board and say, how do we close this gap? And in 2013, the amendments were passed to the BBB legislation. And those amendments then assisted to close some of the gaps. But primarily, they then created a monitoring regulator, which is the BBB Commission. So the BBB Commission now is supposed to now oversee now the implementation, ensure that we implement BBBE in the way that it should impact the economy of this country. So everybody should be implementing it consistently, properly, so that we can achieve the result. At the moment, it's in pockets. Yes, there are some good deals, and I think people must not think that we are saying that there are no good BEE deals. But I must tell this committee that in the time that we have had in this commission, some of the deals that were published as the BE deals are not worth the paper they're written on. So now we need to just go back to basics and just make sure that every deal that is actually announced as a BBBE is a real BBBE deal. But Chair, you will see as we give you some of the matters that we're dealing with, just the activities, then we'll give you some of the things that we are dealing with right now. And you will see why it's important that there should be some monitoring process that we, one, simplify the application of these codes. If it's simple, then it will make it easier for everybody to apply it. But also, if we apply it consistently and over a certain period of time, we can then have the impact.
Check. I want to check something with you as you're doing this broad overview, Commissioner. And that is the issue of trust. You spoke about the employee shared whatever. If the employees are allocated the shares in a trust and they are, in fact, the direct owners of this trust, as it were, but that the company itself has a representative, if you like, on the trust.
Yes.
And assists in terms of the administration of the trust. Does it conform to what you would call ownership if indeed the company is allowed, it puts in X, which one thought that would be part of it, whatever X is, but then it pulls out X, and it does so when X has accumulated through interest to say from 1 billion to 1.5, something along those lines, and does not inform the so-called owners, if I can put it that way, then does it qualify under those circumstances? And secondly, I think, Honourable Williams, you'll have to consider leaving to go and provide the quorum and come back. And then the other instance, if you're an owner, I'm not sure how you should not be paid out should you leave, you know, if that's your ownership. And so if you leave, you automatically lose ownership. I mean, how is that possible? In terms of the legislation, is it possible? Have we missed something?
Chair, we will then, if with your permission, Chair, we'll respond to your question just as we deal with the part that deals with those trust and ownership schemes. You will see that there's a lot of abuse. There's a lot of things that shouldn't be happening. Chair, as we indicated, then in 2013, Parliament did amend the legislation to close these gaps, and the codes were then revised to align to the amendments in 2013, and those codes are now effective. And you will see, Chair, that now companies will start now having an opportunity to be assessed under the new codes. And I think as Parliament, you should not be surprised when you hear complaints, because some of them, as they are being assessed under the new codes, they'll drop levels, because the new codes have got now interventions like the sub-minimums, like priority elements, and so forth and so forth. All right. Thank you, Chair. Chair, after then the revised codes, then what was then implemented as well is the trumping provision, because the one thing that happened in 2003 when the BBB legislation was adopted was that it was on the understanding that other pieces of legislation would then be amended to align to the BBB legislation. That never happened. And in most cases, then we started creating fragmentation and difference in application of BBB, you know, from sector to sector. That impacts a lot of things. It impacts compliance. It impacts, it actually even creates just a nightmare for compliance from the part of companies that have got to comply with different sector requirements. So now the trumping provision was implemented, which means that any legislation that was not aligned with the BBB Act as of now amended in 2013, then the BBB Act will then prevail on matters that speak to the BBB issues. So if there's any piece of legislation anywhere in another industry, any sector, if it is not aligned to the BBB legislation, the BBB will prevail. So the trumping provision is in force. Chair, but although, like I indicated, that we started receiving complaints, I think, in fact, the first complaint that we received was from Honourable Alberts in this house. that was the first complaint that we received already last year in September, which we dealt with. But, Chair, up until the 6th of June, we didn't have the power to handle any complaints because we're waiting for the regulations to be published. So the minister published the regulations with which then guides how we handle our complaints and so forth. So effective from June, we're able to deal with our cases. Chair, just in terms of what BBBE is, and I do know that, as I indicated, when we speak BBBE, we speak on the surface. And a lot of people then take the surface and talk about it. But if we go deep into what exactly it is, you'll see that it's a bigger program than what exactly is happening. And some of the things that are wrong about it are not necessarily arising from how it's intended and how it looks like in the legislation. It's how people apply it. So that's where we come in, as I indicated, that our job is to assist the implementation. And in assisting the implementation, we're going to have to simplify the processes so that everybody understands the processes, then we implement it properly. But Chair, the whole aim of the BBBE is to ensure that there's an increase in the number of black people that own, manage, and control the economy. So also, to facilitate management control and management ownership through communities, through workers, that is where we actually, the BBBE encourages the broad-based nature, meaning that companies should not only look at giving shareholding to an individual shareholder, but could actually broaden the shareholding by giving employees a share in the organization or giving a community a share in the organization, depending on how they structure it and how they actually want to impact those communities. So that's the broad-based nature part of it. So there are other collective schemes that are there, but as I indicated, we'll just show you how some of those schemes are abused, and then those are the things that we're dealing with. And then also in terms of just building the human capital and creating the skills for the economy, looking at critical skills, but looking generally in terms of the quality of the skills that are being developed. So the BBBE legislation also then comes in to create a framework to do that. And then, Chair, the other area talks to equitable representation in the workplace. I spoke about that already in terms of the employment equity, for instance. So that is another element that the BBBE seeks to achieve. The preferential procurement that seeks to actually ensure that we open up the market for previously disadvantaged people. So in markets where black people never had an opportunity, this is intended to open up those markets, but also to transform the supply chain of various industry players, to start having black companies to get into the supply chain and to develop and grow so that we can create those industrialists that we're looking for as well. Chair, the other part which is important, and you'll see why we think it's important in our last slide, we've talked about this, the investment in enterprises that are owned by black people or managed by black people. This is the part that is important, because if we want to really achieve what this legislation seeks to achieve, then there needs to be more that's going to happen under this. Because at the moment, black companies are still battling with the issue of just accessing finance to run a business. So now we need to start facilitating the investment in these companies so that they can actually start getting into the economy. But you'll see how BBBE does that. But then BBBE is not the only intervention that should be doing that. So there's a number of other interventions. Like I said, BBBE in itself, it's not about the BBBE Act. So it encompasses also policy interventions from government, the incentive schemes that should be directed at really funding black enterprises to actually start operating and black people to start owning their own companies, as opposed to just buying shares and be passive owners in various entities. So this is the broad nature of what BBBE is all about. So this is just one intervention towards achieving this. Chair, these are the elements that therefore arise from BBBE, and these are in the codes of good practice. So the first element is the element of ownership. So there, companies do get recognized where they've got shareholders that are black, or where they've got If it's a close corporation where the membership is, you know, represented by black people as well, so that accounts for about 25 points. But the ownership element does not only mean that you give somebody shares in the company. So how we look at it in terms of assessing whether this is really ownership that must be recognized, the person that has got those shares must also be able to vote in that company. They must participate in that company. So they must have exercisable voting rights. This is what is missing in most shareholders' agreements. They give a person 25% shares in a company, but then the shareholders' agreement says that the person does not even vote. So once you strip the person the votes, then it becomes fronting. It's no longer ownership that accounts. You can't get full points for that because you know you've stripped something out of that shareholding. So it's exercisable voting rights, it's the economic interest, and also the net value. So we don't only look at whether you have been given 25%, we also look at how much debt do you still own towards that ownership, that shareholding. If you're still owing a lot, then there's no beneficial ownership, so you're actually not an owner at the moment. So what it means that when we then recognize, you don't recognize full points for that. So that talks to ownership. Then we've got management control. Under management control, that's where we speak about the people that are appointed at decision-making structures on board level or executives in a company that are making decisions. This is where, Chair, also we find the kind of fronting that happens. It happens through tokenism. Where people are appointed in positions that look like they're actually decision-making, but they're actually not. But then for purpose of scoring points, the company will score points on that for BEE status. But then it will score point for a face that is on the board, but not necessarily that it actually makes any decision. So that's where fronting also happens in there. So I'll just give examples of those as I go along. Under skills development, the BBB legislation requires also that companies contribute 6% of the payroll towards developing the skills of its employees as well as people that may not be its employees. So it allows the company to actually assist with the skills development both for employees and people that are not employees. Chair, this is where we think that there's an opportunity because there's available resources. That 6% is a huge amount if you take the number of companies that should be contributing that 6%. But at this moment, it is not directed. It is going towards a whole lot of things that are not really making an impact, so it could be directed. Maybe even a portion of it could go towards the education, the higher learning education that is currently a challenge for the country. So we've made our comments and contribution towards that process, and we do believe that here there's an opportunity to actually contribute a lot towards higher learning institutions. The supplier and enterprise development element, this talks to an element where companies get recognized for transforming their supply chain, bringing in now black suppliers that were never on their supply chain, all right? But it goes further, because now the enterprise development element of it talks to if you invest in a black entity, it might be a small entity that you invest in, and then you get recognized for that investment and you get points for that. So it basically adds additional financial resources or support from the private sector towards building black businesses. So if this is properly implemented, we could achieve a lot through it. And I think what we're doing as well is, as we go along, we'll start showing you what is available in terms of figures, numbers, to say, if we're talking about this part, and we say 1% of net profit after tax, and we look at how many companies are there, this is how much is available. This is how much the country can benefit. So we'll start showing you that. The last part is the socio-economic development. That's the fifth element that companies are required to contribute towards. This is where sometimes this is confused with CSI programs in the organization. This is not CSI. This is interventions that companies do that facilitate entry into the mainstream economy. So it's economic interventions, not donations towards social welfare or animal welfare. It's not. And so what we've said is that some companies that do put a lot of money towards that, but they want to be recognized for donating. It's not donations. It must be creating opportunities. It must be developing people so that they get into the economy, not donations. So it's 1% their net profit after tax. And then what's important here is that the beneficiaries of whatever contribution you are making, the beneficiaries must be at least 75% black. So it's important. And I was saying, Chair, that people want to be recognized for donating money to some animal welfare. And we are saying that unless those animals can be classified as black people, only then the recognition can be given, but it can't. It could be a lot of money, but it's not directed towards the right cause. Chair, those are the levels. I'm not going to go through them. But, Chair, on this slide we talk about, when we speak about triple BEE, where it applies is linked to the threshold. So now there are three categories. We've got what we call EMEs, the exempted micro enterprises. Then we have the qualifying small enterprises. Then we've got large enterprises. The exempted entities are those companies below 10 million in terms of turnover. So those ones are not exempted from complying with triple BEE, but they're exempted from getting through a verification process. So they don't have to go through a verification agent to verify them, to confirm that, yes, you are a small company below 10 million turnover, yes, you are a black company, or yes, you are 51% black owned. They don't need to do that. They can just do an affidavit. This was an intervention that was done to reduce the cost of doing business for smaller entities. So if you are a small entity, whether you are a black or a white company, you will be enjoying this exemption. So if you're let's say you're a small white company that is below 10 million and you've got 51% black shareholders as well, or whatever the shareholding, you don't have to go and say and verify yourself and get somebody to say this is what you are. All you need to do is to go and do an affidavit to say this is what I am. So it reduces the burden for every entity, irrespective of whether they are owned by white people or black people. Then the qualifying enterprises are also the ones between 10 million but less than 50 million. So those ones, there's also some little exemption for them in terms of compliance cost. So in that one, they also can just do an affidavit to confirm their status. But where they want to actually move up in terms of their level, they can then be verified. They can subject themselves to a verification process. That will be their choice. So even if they've got to pay, it's their choice. And then in terms of the large entities, is all of the entities above 50 million?
Can I just ask a clarity question quickly?
Yes, thank you, Honourable Hill-Lewis.
What is the automatic level that the EMEs get with the affidavit?
Level one and level two.
But that's only if they're 51%. I'm saying if they're 25% owned, black owned, or what, are they still level one?
Okay. Just ask Liz, please can clarify that quickly.
Okay. They get automatic level four. Okay, and then if it's 50% and more, 50% more is level two. And then if they're 100%, then it's level one.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner.
All right. We've given the categories, Chair. And then just here, Chair, that's where we talk about some of the powers of the Minister that were clarified by the 2013 legislation. We're not going to go through detail on that, but it clarified what the powers of the Minister is in relation to sector codes. It also clarifies the issue around where government wants to put higher requirements than what is required in the codes, what is the process that government must follow. So state-owned entities, government departments, there's a process that they must follow. They must apply to the minister for an exemption or a deviation or a permission to exceed. So these are the three processes that they must do. This is intended to create transparency so that a particular company doesn't wake up only today and say, we demand 75% black owned. So there must be a basis towards that so that everybody knows that this is what you can expect if you go to this particular company in this particular sector, if it's a state-owned entity. So those three processes are outlined in the regulations. They are requirements to be met, and once that is done, then the minister is required to publish that in the Gazette so that everybody knows what is required in whatever sector. Chair, this is the framework, and we've touched on this framework before. These are the structures that are established by the BBBE legislation. The one that is not in the BBBE legislation is the Companies Tribunal. The Companies Tribunal, we've added that in terms of our processes because the number of issues that we deal with, we pick up that there's a lot of disputes between shareholders, minority shareholders and the majority shareholders. So you find that there's disputes between the BEE partners and the other shareholders. And these disputes are sitting in court for a very long time. And the BEE partners do not have the funds to actually deal with those. So we're saying that the Companies Tribunal is mandated in terms of the Companies Act to deal with disputes between shareholders. So these are disputes that must go there. So we facilitate the process for them to be resolved there speedily. So even where we receive a complaint, where we pick up that this is just a dispute that can be resolved, then we refer to that. Chair, this is the mandate in terms of the Act. I think as we go through the discussion, then we'll see what our mandate fully is. But we've got the powers to investigate and the powers to register a company, sorry, BEE deals, major BEE deals. We're still waiting for just the minister to issue the threshold. And the threshold will say at what level a deal must be to be registered with us. So the minister will issue that soon. There's a process that is underway in the department to deal with that. Chair, what is fronting? I've already tried to give some examples about it, but the amendments in 2013 made it clear and made it broad because fronting takes so many forms, so you can't just have it very narrow. So fronting means that any conduct, transaction arrangement, act, or even omission that directly or indirectly frustrate or undermine the objectives of the Act or makes it impossible or difficult for us to implement the Act, that will be fronting. That is why I said that with every deal that we see, we look at the detail of the deal. Some deals are just not worth that. These are the penalties, Chair. If a person is found to be violating the BBBE legislation, their contracts with government could be cancelled, or licenses that they have with government, if they were found to be fronting, that could be cancelled. They could also be excluded from doing business with government for a period of up to 10 years. They could also be exposed to a fine of up to 10% of their turnover. And the natural persons there could also be imprisoned and be subjected to a fine as well. So those are the penalties that apply under the BBBE legislation now is amended. In terms of the process, we've got a complaint process where a person wants to complain, they can complain directly by completing a BBBE 7 form. But also where people want to complain anonymously, they are allowed to do that. So if a person doesn't want to be known, because what we pick up is that in this space, there's many people like employees are afraid to complain because they could be intimidated or for complaining. So we allow them to complain anonymously, and then the commission will then take up that complaint as if it was initiated by itself. So we do that. Then we've got a process that we've introduced, Chair, which we think is going to be so valuable to companies. It's an advisory opinion service where companies need to give us their deals, their initiatives, their contracts up in advance. We can look at them and advise them to see if there's anything that is contrary to the BBBE legislation. We're already seeing the take-up in that. And then in terms of just the... Yes, for now. Yes. For now, it's for free. All right. Then in terms of the compliance report, Chair, in terms of Section 13G of the BBBE Act, and certain entities are required to report to the Commission in terms of their compliance with the BBBE and their status in terms of BBBE. We've already received complaints in that, and you'll see in our activity report now. And then we also are offering what we call written clarifications. So written clarification, how that is different from advisory opinion is that written clarification can just be a question on how to apply what section of the code or how to apply what section of the act. But with the advisory opinion is where you want to us to talk to you about a set of facts. So it could be a transaction that you're working with. So that's the difference. So we have a commitment of 5 days turnaround time for a clarification, and we're doing very well so far, Chair. And just in terms of then organizing our work to meet the mandate that I've already touched on in terms of 13F, we've got a compliance program which then talks to all of our compliance-related matters. Our opinions are falling there, education and awareness, all of the things that are intended to proactively achieve compliance. And then our investigations and enforcement deals with where compliance has broken down and there's errors, and then the investigation comes in and so forth, Chair. So, but it touches on all of our mandate. Chair, let me just ask Nondo just to take you through the activities, and then you'll pick up the trends there, and then we'll then summarize, and then that will be the end of the presentation. Thanks.
Thank you. This certainly is getting exciting now that it's becoming more operational fully. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chairperson and the Acting Commissioner. As she already indicated, I'll be taking the House through the activities that were undertaken by the BBB Commission. As she indicated earlier on, that we started our operations effectively with effect from 1st of April. Within the Department of Trade and Industry, and currently we have 14 staff members, but the DTI, as the responsible department, is in the process of securing an office space for the BBB Commission. I think I must emphasize the fact that although we are operating within the DTI, we have our own corporate identity, and we also make our own decisions, as she indicated earlier on. And in terms of Section 14, subsection 1 of the BBB Act, the Commissioner, the Minister issued regulations on 6 June 2016, which obviously gave us a clear indication of the processes in executing our mandate. Some of those processes were pertaining to the complaints processes, the prescribed forms, as well as the turnaround time that must be complied with when dealing with the complaints. The BBB Commission is implementing its compliance and enforcement strategies simultaneously, which is we're conducting both the education and awareness sessions throughout the country, as well as investigating the complaints that we have received. In terms of the budget, we are operating within the budget that has been allocated by the DTI, and we also guided by the DTI policies since we're operating within the DTI. However, when it comes to decision-making relating to our mandate, we exercise our own independence. Then I'll also touch on the activities that we have performed with from April until September 2013. Of those activities, we have issued 14 advisory opinions, as well as 136 written clarifications. Advisory opinions, as she indicated, that those are the advices pertaining to the BE transactions, whereas the written clarifications are just inquiries pertaining to the implementation of the BBB Act. We also had 120 meetings with our stakeholders, meetings pertaining to the advice on the BBB transactions, as well as complaints meetings. Of those 120 meetings that we held, 16 of them were walk-ins. The other activity that we also performed was the assessment of the Black Industrialist applications. As we recall that the DTI is the custodian of the Black Industrialist program. So on receipt of those applications, they send them to us to review them and detect any fronting practice, possible fronting practice. We also issued letters to all government departments, accounting officers, that is the director generals of those departments, on compliance with the BBB Act. Some of the activities that we have also performed include issuing the practice guide on third-party procurement, just to guide the effective implementation of the Act. The other one was the practice guide on the certificates of the exempted micro enterprises. We also issued an explanatory note on the procedure that must be followed for requesting advisory opinions. And then in terms of education and awareness sessions as well as presentations, we have held 7 information sessions in 4 provinces, that is KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, Western Cape, and Northwest. We also made some presentations to Department of Communications Transformation Colloquium and other organizations as well. We also had 2 presentations made to the BBBE Advisory Council on activities of the BBBE Commission. And then the other thing that we've also done is to issue some instructions to some companies or entities that had some issues that were undermining the BBBE legislation. Of those was the one that was issued to Axides and Innovent Fronting Seminar, which they intended to hold in Centurion in Pretoria, where they were saying that they were inviting delegates to attend that seminar because they were saying that the fronting has a legal zone, so they're inviting people to come and explore that fronting zone. So what happened is that upon being aware, the BBBE Commission instructed those companies to cancel the seminar and also refund the delegates because the delegates were required to pay an amount of 2,400. Indeed, the seminar was cancelled and the delegates were refunded. The next instruction was pertaining to the net value holdings, where they also wanted to have sessions in Gauteng and in Cape Town, where they were saying that they were inviting partners, saying that they want BBBE partnership that will be tailored for their business. So we also felt that that was also undermining the objectives of the BBBE legislation. The last instruction was regarding the withdrawal of a misleading statement which was made by the Association of BBBE Professionals, where they were suggesting that they were the authorized or approved verification professional body, whereas that was misleading and not true, because as you recall that we only have 2 professional regulators for professional bodies, that is SANAS as well as ERPA, that were authorized by the minister to accredit and approve verification professionals. However, as you may be aware, the ERPA has since exited the space with effect from 30 September 2016, and that has left now only SANAS to accredit the verification professionals. And in terms of the compliance reports, which the commissioner has touched on earlier on in her presentation, in terms of Section 13G, we have received 8 compliance reports coming from either the government public entities, spheres of government, CETAs, etc., and those compliance reports are currently under consideration. The commissioner earlier on indicated something about the threshold that still has to be issued by the minister regarding the transactions that must be submitted to the BBBE Commission for registration. However, what we've also done is to proactively call upon 2 possible major transactions, and we've considered those. There were also some information dissemination activities that took place through TV, radio, print, and electronic media platforms, including social media. And then we've also written submissions to various organizations or bodies, making our position or contribution, one of them being the submission written to Treasury regarding the PPSA regulations, the second one being the concept of the proposed implementing agent which was sent to the BBBE Advisory Council, and then we've also made the submission and the contribution to the ministerial team which is led by Mr. Sizwe Nqasana for short-term funding for higher education. I think that's the one that Commissioner touched on earlier on pertaining to that portion of the skills development funds. And then the last one, we also made the submission made our position clear with regard to once empowered, always empowered principle, and that was submitted to the Minister of Trade and Industry. We also issued letters to the verifiers and accounting officers for the incorrect verification certificates that were issued. And lastly, we issued letters to the professional bodies to which the verification practitioners or professionals are affiliated. And now, in terms of Section 13J, which gives us the authority to handle complaints, we have received a lot of complaints, and the number that we have received until this September 2016 is 124. And you, as you will recall that earlier on, we indicated that we started our operations with effect from 1st of September. But when you look at the time we received the first complaint, which was October last year, it really shows that people out there, they have burning concerns. And then we also issued 136 clarifications. And lastly, we issued advisory opinions, which we explained what those are, to a number of 14. And then in terms of complaints that we have received, the categorization of complaints that we have received, of the 134 that we received, 84%, which is 112, relates to fronting. I think Commissioner correctly stated the fact that fronting is a corrupt activity. So obviously you can see that really there are people who do not sleep at night trying all means to just circumvent the BBB legislation. And in that way, delaying the equality and the economic transformation which this the legislation seeks to achieve. But with the investigations that are currently underway, we are certain that those culprits will be brought to book. And then the second type of complaint pertains to the BBB certificates, where you find that there are fraudulent certificates in circulation and that are submitted to also government entities, and those entities, they receive contracts. And also the unacceptable practice by the verification professionals who...
Everyone focused on what we're hearing, because I think there are a number of questions that are arising out of them. Thank you.
All right. As I was still saying, that the B certificates also pertain to the conduct of the verification practitioners who issue the certificates without following the necessary processes. For instance, one of the requirements is that they should conduct interviews, but then the allegations are that those interviews are never conducted. Then the third type of complaint being the contract standing at 7 and others. And then in terms of categorization of complaints per sector or industry, we have transport with standing at 23%, and those relate to owner-driver schemes. We also have the second highest, mining, with 15%, and the last, the third highest being the construction with 9%. And then in terms of the geographical location of the complaints, whether where the complainants are coming from or the respondents are coming from, we have Gauteng being the highest, where you find that the complainants are sitting at 44%, and then the respondents are sitting at 51%. But that one would wonder why the disparity between the complainant and the respondent. The reason behind that is the fact that you find that in some instances the complainant is in one province and the respondent is in another province. But then we have also instances where you find that both the complainant and the respondent are in one province. So as I indicated earlier on, Gauteng is the highest, followed by Northwest and Free State, both having 11% of complainants as well as 10% of respondents and other provinces as well. But I think the picture that we're trying to paint here is the fact that all provinces have problems relating to the circumvention or violation of the BBB legislation. I think lastly, I also previously indicated the fact that we've held meetings with our stakeholders, giving them advice on the proposed transactions as well as complaints, where the total to date is 120, 16 of those being the walk-ins. So I'll end there and hand over back to the Commissioner to wrap up. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just if we can just wrap up, based on what we've given you, what we've done is that although we're saying emerging issues, these are not new issues, it's just that we are highlighting them because this is what we are seeing happening every day. All right. Chair, when I was saying that this task has been extremely traumatizing for me, and I think for the team, because what we see is really traumatizing, and I mean it, and you will see what I'm talking about now. Chair, Just in terms of the first thing around the once empowered, always empowered. I'm not going to talk about the legal case and everything that is there. I'm going to talk about the principle. The intention of BBBE is to empower black people. So the principle that is being purported around once empowered, always empowered, means that when you have allowed or where you've had black partners in the business and they leave for whatever reason, then you must continue to be recognized that they are there even when they have left. That is what this once empowered, always empowered means. And the reason that is advanced for that is that when you've entered into a triple B deal, there is a cost involved in that. And it's not a one thing that you decide as a company just on one day, and then you decide, no, now I'm bringing in a black partner, then that's it. It's a serious negotiated process because you are now giving equity. So it's a negotiated process. There are a whole lot of elements. So there are practical realities around it. That is the reason why that is given. What we are saying is that the codes already recognize that. In terms of the codes, where you've had a proper ownership, for instance, a transaction, if the black partners exit for whatever reason, maybe they want to sell their shares, they want to realize their value, and they want to exit, there is a principle that is already accommodated for in the codes, which we call the continuing recognition principle. That means that for a particular period, let's say up to 3 years, you could still get to be recognized for that deal if that deal was proper from the onset. So it already allows for that. So that is in there. So what is being argued now is something beyond that. So what it means is that if you had black partners and the deal was not a fronting deal, what is being argued that it must be recognized anyway for a particular period even after those guys have left. So that is where we are objecting to it. We're saying that it's already allowed for in the legislation. The continuing recognition principle already allows for it, but it's got requirements. It says that ownership deal must have been right. It must have been correct. So those black partners must have realized value. They must have had exercisable voting rights. So it must have been a proper deal from the onset. So we can't argue anything that is going outside those parameters. So that is...
But it's just on clarity on what's just been said. I just want to know the section of the legislation being referred to, please. I'd like to read it.
Yes, it's in Code Series 100. So Liso will also assist just with those things. So the recognition of the black partners that have already exited has already been catered for. It is understood that a deal is not a once-off and one-day thing event. So it allows for that, for companies to do that. So we are happy with allowing for a transition that enables companies to get into another ownership deal that is proper. But we are opposed to recognition of a deal that was never even right from the beginning. So that is where our difference is. We're saying that if it was a proper deal, it will already qualify for that kind of recognition. So, Chair, that is an issue that we're making our view known on that one, on a matter of principle, not in relation to a particular case or a particular matter that is subject on the table at the moment. In terms of the sector code, Chair, the whole purpose of sector codes, it's supposed to recognize the unique features in a particular sector which requires certain deviation from the codes of good practice as they are. So it is allowed that in a particular sector, there will be unique features. So what we are picking up is that companies are using sector codes and the generic codes. They go and verify themselves under the sector code. If the level is low, then they go under the generic code, then they want to measure themselves under the general code. It's not supposed to be like that. If you are in a sector, if you are in transport, and transport has a sector code, if you are a company operating in that industry, you can never have a certificate issued to you under the general code. You must be measured under your sector code. So the trends that we are picking up is that companies are status hopping. So they go on this side. If this gives them a better level, they go on this side. And those certificates are invalid. If you were issued a certificate that is based on general codes, it's invalid. So we're seeing a lot of those certificates, Chair. The letters that Nondogo talked about, the 22 letters that we've already sent to verification agents, is where we've picked up the discrepancies in terms of the certificates that were issued. So we're dealing with those on a proactive level. But then where we find that there's continued behavior like that, we'll then start putting that into investigations. So on this one, Chair, this issue is a challenge for us because the sooner we have a complete process around sector codes, then the more certainty we can create in the market. At the moment, we think that people are taking advantage of that uncertainty, and so obviously Eliso and the ministry are dealing with the alignment of those sector codes, and we are saying that that process just needs to be expedited so that we get the kind of certainty that we require to monitor properly. And then in terms of access to funding, Chair, in all the cases that we're dealing with, what we pick up as a trend is that a lot of black partners, whether it's employees in an employee share scheme or it's black people that are acquiring equity in a company, there's issue of access to finance. So what happens is that the deal is structured on the basis that the company is financing the deal. So when the company is financing the deal, the company then puts its own terms on the table, which cannot really be negotiated. So often the terms that are put on the table are terms that are not favorable to the empowerment process. So you find that they will then still, for instance, Chair, you spoke about the trust. Where a company creates an employee scheme that uses a trust, what you find is that the employer appoints the trustees to that trust. Then that's no longer an empowerment deal. So that is completely wrong already because they're not supposed to do that. If that is a trust, the people that are beneficiaries to this trust are the ones that need to be appointing the people that are going to be a trustees. So what we're picking up, that is not what is happening. And that arises from the power imbalance. But the large part of the power imbalance comes from the point where the deal is being financed by the very same company. So the negotiating terms are always not favorable. So if we go back to the definition of fronting, one of the examples that definition gives is that where the terms of the deal are not favorable to the person that you're seeking to empower, that is fronting. So now, if you have a structure that looks like that, you've got a shareholders agreement that basically makes a black person a shareholder but who has no voice whatsoever, that is fronting. So, but what we are picking up, Chase, because the limited access to funding that black entities have is actually derailing the extent to which they could be empowered. So we're saying here on our side as the commission is that, yes, we do not have a role, we can't offer any funding, but we think that government needs to pay attention to this and make sure that they create an environment for additional funding to black entities. And as well as to just create an environment where also the private sector funding could come in. And there's also what we call, Chair, the mentality that comes with where, in the complaints that we're dealing with, for instance, where the black shareholder requests information from the company. They don't have the copy of the shareholders agreement. They don't have the financial statements. When they ask for that, they're being told that, no, but these are free shares. You didn't pay anything for it. So you actually don't, you are not entitled to that information. So that's what we're getting. It's because of the point balance that come as a result of somebody putting the money on the table. And so we think that needs to be enhanced. So in terms of the free shares, the company continues to tell the shareholders that, but you've got free shares, so you really don't have a say in the company. Once you're a shareholder, you have the obligations. If the company gets involved in some corrupt activities, whether or not you are voting, you're going to be responsible fully for that. So you are a shareholder or you are a director in that company. So the obligations that are attached to any director, they are attached to you. So you are entitled to those documents. But what we pick up, that all of that gets to be stripped off. So all of the cases that we're dealing with, this is the pattern that we see. So the shareholders, for instance, the majority of the black shareholders that we've picked up, they've never been interviewed by a verification agent. And in terms of the verification process, the verifier, before they can issue a verification certificate, they must interview the specific questions to confirm that indeed this is a shareholding that can be recognized full points. They've never been recognized. They've never been interviewed. But a certificate of level BE2 has been issued. So those are the things that are coming out. In terms of government implementation, I alluded, Chair, firstly to the first complaint that we received, which was submitted by Honourable Albert in this House. The complaint was really about the lack of compliance by the state-owned entities themselves. And what we're saying, Chair, this is serious. The reason why this is serious is that if there is lack of compliance, for instance, with the BBBE requirements, for instance, the permission to exit, you need to get it from the minister, and it must be in the Gazette. If you want to deviate from these codes, you need to get the permission from the minister to do that. And so government entities themselves are not coming forth for this. So we're saying that this is important. We've written to all of them to say that they need to do that. Because what this does is that it continues to create the fragmentation and the lack of clarity that leads to a whole lot of litigation against state entities on contracts and grants that are being given or awards. So we have written to all of them to actually do that. Also, Chair, in this one as well, I spoke around the exempted micro-enterprises, that there was a decision to reduce the cost of doing business to them. Certain government departments still insist on these small entities that they must submit a BEE certificate. That is illegal, that is wrong, that is incorrect, that is contrary to this legislation. So we have then engaged the National Treasury. The Office of the Chief Procurement Officer issued an instruction to all government departments again to remind them that you must change your requirements, because what you're doing is that you're actually continuing to subject these small entities to a cost that they should not be bearing as small entities. So we have written to the government departments, again, all of the DGs, reminding them about that requirement so that they can implement it. And we have received already complaints regarding some departments that that were continuing to demand the BE certificates, which is incorrect, it's wrong. Chair, the other thing that I want to talk to is the abuse of the certain arrangements that are valid within the BE framework, but that are being abused. That talks to, Chair, the trust that you're talking about. We have already picked up in all of the complaints, in the majority of the complaints that relate to employee schemes, the trust as used is abused. So the trust is used to actually provide, so a trust is used to be an intermediary between the employee who's supposed to be a direct owner in the company. So the employee doesn't own directly. But what happens is that if you look at the trust deed actually turns that employee into just a beneficiary. So they're actually not the owner of the company. That is why when they leave the organization, they leave as if they are not owners. They are not even paid off for that ownership to show that they are exiting. So that is abuse. That is what we call fronting. That is fronting at its best. So now there is the people that are drafting these trust deeds and all of these contracts, they are not distinguishing between a black person as a beneficiary and a black person as an owner. So what you see is that you see a scheme that looks like it's an ownership scheme, but it's not. It's purported to be an ownership scheme, but the trust deed says something completely different. And then the other abuse of the trust as a structure is where I said that a trust is used to dilute the ownership, because instead of a company giving a shareholding or direct ownership, they will introduce a trust. So you hold shares through a trust. So, but in this trust, there's no assets, there's nothing. So you basically are owning nothing, really. So the value of your shareholding is diluted through opportunistic intermediaries that are put in the structure, so that ultimately you really don't have the real value. And that impacts on the requirements around ownership, which we spoke about. There must be economic interest. There must be net value at the end of the day. So when they put these interventions in terms of the trust and all of that, it's when the ownership is being diluted. So we see those type of shareholders agreements every day. Those trustees, we see them every day. Spamanza goes through all of those every day, where we're always shocked how come we have structures like this. So, and I said, as I was saying, even the ones that you think, the ones that you think are okay, they're not okay. So we have looked into that. Then there's the one other part, Chair, which we call the modified flow-through principle. This is also getting abused. The modified flow-through principle means that if there is a if the company that owns a group of other companies, like subsidiaries, is already empowered, the ones that are under it can then be recognized for that. But how it's being used right now, it's, there's an abuse in the sense that they create a trust separate there that now looks like it owns all of the groups. So this trust now is 51% black. Then they translate that down to all of the other companies. But this trust is not even operating, it's nothing. It's just a structure, but it purports to bring in the black ownership onto the group of companies. That is the abuse that is happening every day. So when you see all of these trusts, it's important that we go through them and look at them. Chair, the one part that we need to talk to is the issue around the abuse of the definition of black person within the context of BEE. Within the context of BEE, it's clear what is it that we mean by black people. So what we have seen, which is also confirmed by the Commission of Employment Equity, there's an increase in bringing in black foreign nationals and seeking to recognize them as black people for the purpose of BEE. And we're seeing that continuously. And we have had matters where we've taken up verification agents that have done that. And we go deep into who is this person and why did you recognize them for full points when actually they are not South African. So they're not supposed to benefit under that. So that is the abuse that we're also picking up. Then there's this issue around, and this, I am saying it because it's always difficult when we're talking about the willing frontiers, the people that are making themselves available to be fronted for a quick buck. This is a problem. This is black people that are not necessarily people that are illiterate. It's not people that don't know what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. But what they're doing is abusing BBBE, and they are making the country to regress. So what they do is that they sell themselves. When Nontokozo was talking about, for instance, the reason why we stopped the session, the sessions that Net Value Holdings wanted to do in Cape Town and Gauteng, Net Value Holding was selling itself as a partner, a BEE partner. So they want companies that want them as a partner. They are saying that we are available to be your BEE partner. We will not bother you. We don't even want voting rights. We don't want anything. So that is wrong. How is it that you want to be a shareholder but you don't want to vote? Because the ownership things here are saying that you must exercise the votes. You must be fully participating. So that is wrong. So we are seeing it continuing. There's a lot of people that are just chasing equity, a bit of equity, even if it's 5% in a company, so that they can, every year or every month, they can get a dividend from that company. So it's a financial benefit that people are pursuing. And these are people that are taking us backwards, Chair. And we think that also, Chair, if this House can really, really speak very strong against that, because it's really, really making our job very difficult. Chair, the last part is around the verification agents. The verification process in itself is already compromised as we speak right now. The number of verification certificates, all BE certificates that we're seeing, some may be legitimate, but we have reason to believe that a lot are not legitimate. Because if we look at the statistics that we are working with, and we see the number of people that have never been interviewed, then already you must question the level that you see on the certificate. So this is an area that we decided to focus on. We started already work with the verification practitioners themselves. We are working in sessions with them in terms of improving the quality of the verification process, because every person that receives a certificate, they must trust that certificate. At the moment, the process is compromised. So this is the area, Chair, that we're working on, and we are saying that, we know that the department is fine-tuning that process to finalize the proper regulation and standards for this verification professional, so that ultimately we don't have all of these discrepancies, Chair. Chair, I think just to then to conclude, we really are having a lot of work on our table. We don't have the adequate resources that we need, but we will not come to this committee to try and lament on resources. We'll address the issues about resources when we address them. But we just need to say that the amount of work that is coming through obviously requires that we have adequate financial and also human resources that needs to match that. And when we created the Consumer Commission, we actually thought we were going to have so many walk-ins consumers that are coming in to complain. But we find that on BEE, we have so many walk-ins. People are coming in, walk-in like this is a consumer issue. So our walk-ins are so high that we're actually beginning to have a challenge, because we are based in the DTI, so still waiting for our office space. Our resources are, we don't have enough meetings just for people walking in. So we must always have somebody on standby to address a person that walks in. So we try to be flexible around that, but we're just raising that it shows that there's a whole lot of concerns in this space that and the demand that we'll have to meet in terms of the needs. Chair, just in terms of the Black Industrialist Program, what we were requested to do as the Commission is to assess the ownership and the operational involvement requirements of the BI scheme. So this is intended to prevent situation of fronting, so that we don't have the Black Industrialist Program money given to companies that are already practicing fronting. So this is what we do up front. So the department sends us those and we assess them. We've got a turnaround time for them of 10 days. So we've already looked at them. But I must say, Chair, of the ones that we've looked at, let me tell you what the trend is. The trend is the BI scheme was announced some 2 years back. Most of the companies, the 51% black ownership only happened last year or just after the scheme was announced. So the black people just come in for the purpose of applying for the scheme. So there's that trend that is taking place. So we're trying to make sure that we then analyze the transaction, so the application in detail, the ownership structure, and then we then will alert the department, and that in that process they'll make their decisions, but we alert them in terms of the fronting indicators that we are picking up on that. But I'm just saying that as a trend, don't be surprised. Remember that in mining, because there was a requirement about 26%, every black shareholding will be 26%. So with the BI scheme, there is 51% requirement minimum, isn't it, black? So every scheme is like 51%. But when you look at it, the entrant, the 51% black shareholder only comes in last year. They've never been involved in the company at all, at all. And if you look at the organogram, they're not there. They've never been there. So it's opportunistic structures that are created to access a particular fund. So, Chair, let me close by that and saying that we look forward to making some intervention, because I think we see our role as building a proper foundation for BEE to achieve the results. And as we do that, we will keep updating yourselves, but we do think that our compliance strategy is beginning to give us some results. We are seeing a lot of companies approaching us on a voluntary basis, coming to ask us about their schemes, even the schemes that have already been concluded. They come to us and ask us if we think this is the correct one. And we see value in that, because we can then, you know, correct, but also prevent some of the fronting practices from taking place. So in our investigations, we'll deal then with the enforcement part that has got to do with the fronting that is deliberate, that should not be tolerated, Chair. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Commissioner. We do appreciate that from you and your team. I know that there are going to be quite a few comments and questions, so let's just say at the outset we're looking at perhaps 2 rounds, 3 minutes to start. The Honourable Williams, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Kernoff, and Honourable Montash, Honourable Mkongi. Thank you very much, Honourable William.
Thanks, Chair. Firstly, I just want to welcome the input. I've only got four questions. The first question goes around, on one of your slides you talked to 84% of complaints are around fronting. I just want to know, to what extent do Chambers of Commerce assist the Commission to eradicate fronting, if any at all? In fact, what I want to know is, do Chambers of Commerce assist the Commission in any way at all? Secondly, unfortunately your slides didn't have page numbers, so I can't refer to page numbers, but one of your slides talked to the socioeconomic development, that 1% of net profit after tax be spent on that, and that 75% of that money goes to black beneficiaries. I'd like to know, does Sasol, the big retailers, the big private sector companies, do they actually do this, and how do you verify this? Because if you take 1% of Sasol's profit, it's billions and billions of rands, and I'd like to know how you verify that this money is actually being spent on black people and not on on the socioeconomic development of black people, and not on, for instance, sponsoring rugby teams or sports teams. The next point I have, is there anything that prevents people who are guilty of fronting from doing it again? In other words, then I could be running around fronting and then, you know, I just keep doing it. And then lastly, what action, if any, is taken against companies that have government contracts, but they subcontract some of that work to companies that are guilty of violation of BBBEE legislation? In other words, then my company could comply to the legislation 100%. I get a contract with government, and then I employ other companies to do the job that are not, you know, that are not compliant. I just want to know what happens there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much. Is this working? Okay. Thank you. Nice to see you again, Ms. Ntuli, and your team. Just a couple of questions. It does concern me the number of examples that one sees of state-owned entities not complying with the legislation, often to the detriment of small businesses in particular. And so, you know, I'd like a slightly more specific feedback on your progress in terms of getting coordination between the state-owned entities and, indeed, other state departments. The other big concern I have is the kind of bewildering number of sector charters that come out that we see. They get emailed to us. And when I try to read as many of them as I can, many of them also go way beyond what the legislation says. Now, you know, the whole point of the trumping clause, as I recall it, was, as you have expressed today, to create a sense of certainty in the market and to create a sense of compliance clarity. But those sector charters, because they all differ from one another and they all differ from the codes, that they go right back to creating a whole lot of confusion and a whole lot of uncertainty about what exactly needs to be complied with. And I really feel like sometimes those charters are not drawn up by BEE specialists, and so they actually undo some of the good work that has been done in the generic codes and in the legislation. So, you know, I can give you some examples of, for example, they reduced the EME from 10 million to 1 million. Now, if you think of a ordinary startup business in, you know, employing two or three people, it's extremely easy to hit the 1 million mark in a year because of turnover, remember, not profit. And then they've got to start spending thousands and thousands of rands on verification. And that undoes the whole point of the EME allowance that was in the codes, and yet I see many of the sector charters doing that now, reducing that EME bracket down to 1 million. So I don't think that there's nearly enough coordination taking place, and I think some of those charters are actually undoing the good work of the codes. Then, on the once empowered, always empowered, this is obviously a critical discussion. But I don't agree with you that the key concern of business is just the transaction costs. That is obviously a concern. But I've looked through the section that you have referred to on page 68 of this Act, and it allows for a 3-year essentially allowance, as I understand it. Now, if you think about if you own 100% of something and you want to meet the targets, so you do a transaction in which you do a 25% black ownership transaction, you now own 75% of your business. If in 3 years' time you have to do another one of those transactions, now all of a sudden you only own 50% of your business. Those 25% shares have gone somewhere else. They've been sold, as is the right of the owner to sell them, the black owner to sell them. But you can't get those shares back. You've now got to sell another 25% of your shares to another black owner. And so now, after only two deals, you only own 50% of your business. Anything more than that, and you're a minority shareholder in your own business. So you can understand why there would be a lot of hesitation to do that. I totally understand that, frankly. And that brings me to the discussion around employee share ownership schemes and trusts.
Going into 5 minutes.
Am I really? Okay, well, I'll happily leave it for the second. No, it's more than a sentence.
Thank you very much. But there is another round, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Colonel.
Thank you, Chair. Just to carry on where he left, if I'm a black-owned, empowered person, and I got my 25% of the shares, and I then sell it to Mr. Hill Lewis, then suddenly that company is white again. And that is happening, unfortunately. I just would like your comment on that. And then many, many years ago, there were employment trusts formed, you know, and then the farm workers became beneficiaries, and then there were certificates issued to them to tell them, you know, the nominal value of your investment will be that. But in those trust deeds, they say if you leave this company, you become a bad leaver. You know, there was a disciplinary action against you, and then you're a bad leaver. Then you walk out after 10 or 12 or 15 years, you just walk out with nothing. Now, that is happening all the time now. Now, my question is there a recourse? Can those employees now go back and maybe lay a complaint to the commission to say what they've done 12 years ago or 10 years ago in terms of the sections of or the clauses in their trust deed, it's illegal now. Is there a recourse or not? And then further, the CEO of Volkswagen, I think he has said this week, that Volkswagen will never get more than a level 3 level 3 status.
Yeah.
And the reason is they cannot find black suppliers to do business with in the automotive industry. Now, what do we say to the Fords and the BMWs and the Mercedes-Benz companies if they can never reach more than level 2 because of no black suppliers they can do business with?
Thank you, Honourable Quernell. Honourable Montage.
I was worried, Chairperson, when Honourable Quernell lands, he says, where would they get the black suppliers? Is it that there are no black suppliers, or is it that they're not prepared to have black suppliers? Chairperson, my eyes are opened a bit with the presentation by the entity. I've been looking around for many BEE deals or BEE companies.
Honourable Montash, I must stop you there. You're very inaudible. I've just checked here, you know, to make sure it's not my ear.
Maybe this is.
All right.
I was saying, when we were speaking, I was thinking of many BE companies that had trusts. And my mind goes back to where I come from in my other life, where you would find, which I want you to go and verify, that trade unions would have, you know, investment companies, and they would, those the members would be represented by trusts. And now when you say so, I'm asking myself, at which point and what do those members benefit out of that scheme? Or is it that it is their names are just used for the benefit of some other people, which is for me the abuse of the act itself. But impressed as I am with your input, I just want to check whether you're going to stay in your office in Pretoria and service all provinces, because there's a lot of companies, PE companies all over South Africa. Are you going to manage on your own in one office in Pretoria? And who's going to do your footwork in other provinces? Do you have inspectors to ensure the implementation of the act? Because it will be, for me, you know, a lip service to say stay in Pretoria, and you think you would have, you know, inspected the country as a whole. What capacity do you have to do what you say you're going to do? Because it's something else to say we'll do this and this and this, but you don't have capacity and warm bodies to do it. The rest I will come back for, Chairperson.
Thank you. I think part of our problem is that sometimes the mic is to the left or right of our sort of voices. So, but we should be audible for us all to hear at the back as well. Honourable Mkongi.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairperson. No, I think, Chairperson, it would be proper for the committee to congratulate the commission for the good work that they have done in a short period. I think this committee must say that thing. Because if you read the report, the verification strategy that they have come with and they are implementing, we propose that strategy this year that they must come with it in this committee. And when I'm seeing this report and the way it's being presented, it makes me to be excited that we are founding a commission that is working to benefit our people. I think we must register that as this parliament today. But what concerns me, because I have a number of issues, is the emerging trends. Because there's a routine here that we draft a law and then there will be emerging trends to make sure that the people, they get away with murder in the first law. We amend that law again, and then there will be new emerging trends of how do I corrupt the very same system. You come with regulations, scholars again, they come with others, that how do we spoil this? How do we deal with that situation? Because that is the very important, you know, pinnacle of the problem that we're facing in South Africa, that people develop new tactics and strategies to make sure that they make the law null and void for them. And this is a challenge that we're facing in this government. It is not only in a difficult terrain of the economy. It is on the broader socio-economic transformation of the country is having this fundamental problem. Do you have another proposal of what could be done to deal with this? Because we will amend these laws for the next coming 20 years and we will have these emerging trends. One, is a question that I call the voluntary fronting. How do you deal with those Africans and black people who are doing that thing in South Africa? If Honorable Mantashe will talk about trusts and so forth in the trade union movement, and then they are not benefiting the very same workers, and we come here and talk about white companies, you know, how do we deal with that and make an example to those who volunteer themselves to corrupt the system. And we have been talking about your first line, the government implementation process. Why is it so difficult for our government to implement what is their law? And what actions can we take? Because some of the actions we have taken, and we have found some resolutions, Chairperson. We have had joint meetings with the finance committee. We have found some few solutions. We had joint committee meetings with others. We found some few solutions. And then what do you think you because we propose that there must be interdepartmental committees that deals with these matters. Are those interdepartmental committees established, and what are the outcomes? Because I will go to the question that since you have begun your job, we had here in this country, when I was still in the portfolio committee on labor in the third parliament.
Just remember, you're heading towards 5 minutes.
Okay. The Employment Equity Commission. They're having reports, either annual reports, on what is the progress made. Are you prepared to do that as this commission, to give us a report on the transformation trajectory in our country? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Mkongi. Now, just let me allow you to take your second round now if you did not complete what you were saying. There were two of you. Honorable Hill Lewis.
I just wanted to come back to the point about employee share ownership schemes, because I'm aware of the amount of abuse that goes on with them, and I've seen some of it myself. But I still think, in principle, they hold the potential to be the best kind of real broad-based empowerment, because the shares and the economic interests are held by ordinary working-class black South Africans, not by wealthy elite black South Africans. And so we really have to figure out a way to make them work properly and better. And so I think it will be really useful if you can draw up, that's why I think your advisory service is very useful. And hopefully you can, even when you do start charging for it, it'll still be much cheaper than the BEE agencies who give advice on these things, because they charge hundreds of thousands of rands. But also, perhaps it would be possible to draw up a kind of model BEE employee share ownership scheme with all of the model trust deeds already drawn up on behalf of the companies, which they can access via your office, which they can then use in the structuring of their deal without having to pay lawyers and all of these expensive consulting fees. I think that could be very, very helpful and add a lot of value if you could design an employee share ownership scheme that is implementable and which achieves the objectives of the Act and of the codes. That is my...
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Mantash.
Chairperson, I have not heard what the consequences would be for those people who have been found to have flouted the Act. And again, what are you going to do to those companies that have already flouted the BEE Act, who are currently in force? What consequences are going to be there for them?
Thank you very much, Honourable Mantosh. Honourable Mkongi.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. A few things. I think I want to support Honourable Lewis on this thing, the ambiguity between the question of ownership and shareholdership. It's very important. We need to have some basic, let's say, points as to explain and how that it happened. I have an Indonesian experience where the ownership patterns that are taking place in South Africa, they are skewed and they are not reality. So we need to have that one. The second one is that the amendments that we have made in 2013, and then we put new codes. What progress have we made? Do you have that information? What progress have we made since then? The last one, Chairperson, is how do we monitor this tokenism issue? Because we have been talking about tokenism since 1996 in South Africa, if you can get to remember, where people are put there as directors, but they're just spices to make the dish taste nice. And we have done nothing about that process. Most of them, they have been comrades, by the way, who worked for the first ministers in 1994, and then they went into the system, and then they were taken. So how do we deal with that situation?
Thank you very much. I just have one or two questions myself. I think you did explain that misleading statement that you referred to on the fronting in the end, that we did go into detail there. But I would have liked to have understood how many of these letters are we talking about? One letter, three letters, 20 letters? You know, what is the significance there? Because it sounds like a serious issue. The other one is communication allows for trans... Oh, yes, you spoke about this, you know, that the Act was not intended to prevent deals being made per se. However, what one had to keep focused was what are the objectives of the Act, and to comply with that, so that when one, through a deal not working out or going adrift, as it were, and you then pursued another deal, there was what you called a transition period. What are we talking about here? A month, 6 months, you know, or is that, negotiable, or depending on the size? A small issue for me is this beautiful pie chart, but it's not very clear. It's a beautiful range of colors. What's what? You know, and I just thought if we could have just indicated the numbering against the legend, you know, that would be helpful to us, because it is an interesting one. But I must say, certainly I'm impressed having watched the gestation of this and some of the challenges that arose initially and how you've begun to address it. But one is alarmed by what the Honourable Hill Lewis also referred to as people, as it were, you know, your intention is to become black-owned or whatever and do the transformation, and then some of the very people, the beneficiaries, get you out of that particular framework. And I think we need to guard against that as well. Over to you, and we would like to have you respond by the time we reach 20 past. Thank you. Members, can I suggest that anyone who's desperate for a cup of tea take their tea, because the tea's been out since 10:30. Thank you. Over to you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to just request Liso to just address some of the issues that I know they relate to policy to a certain extent, and we will then deal with the issues that are implementation on our side. So let me allow Liso to start on some of the issues. There are policy issues that arise from the questions that have been raised. Thanks.
Okay, there's been a number of issues. It's very difficult to determine where we start, but I think importantly is the issue around, I think the issue of prevention on issues pertaining to fronting, I think I just want to allow for the Commission to deal per se with that issue. But I think the issue of compliance by SOEs is to us a critical issue we've also considered from a policy perspective. And this has further been also looked into by the Presidential BEE Advisory Council. And as soon as yesterday, they had a session
where we called in all the state-owned entities following the letters that have been written to them to say, you know, what are the issues, what are the challenges, how far are they with implementing the policy, how far are they with obtaining their own verification certificates in line with the specialized scorecard. And a lot of discussions have taken place. It has emanated that, yes, they are implementing the policy, but they do face limitations in as far as preferential procurement. Although the BE policy may highlight critical issues around how you preference and choose suppliers and how you engage those suppliers, the triple PFA, as it stands and its regulations, sort of prohibits some of the full implementation or what they would want to implement in terms of preferential procurement. And this is something obviously we are working on as it pertains to the procurement bill. And this alignment now per act on the act level is being addressed. But that said, they've got other responsibility in terms of their diversifying their own value chains. So from Transnet and all the way through the rest of them, they are developing supplier development plans. They've established units to deal with this. But as the Commissioner says, the progress is slow, and we are actually working closely with them to ensure that they actually start implementing. The issue of once empowered, always empowered, I think the Commissioner put it quite well. That's the provisions. Yes, you are right, sir. It is found in pages 65, where it speaks of the continuing recognition. But the key thing is that once there's an exit of the black shareholder, they've sold. The intention is that it is possible that they might sell back again to a white business, and that is obviously key to what's the concern. And people are raising the fact that I have created value by selling shares, so why should I now continually sell shares and at a cost, at the administrative cost? I think that's really the crux of the issue, and that's what we've been getting. But from the mere fact, when people sell, you either buy back your shares, then you retain that majority or that percentage ownership. But this is something we've also been looking at. So in as far as the ESOPs, I actually agree 100% with the proposal you had mentioned to create some form of a template, a standard. And this is something actually that has already happened. Within the next month or so, there will be a practice note that will be issued by the department in with regards to this issue regarding broad-based ownership schemes, where we will obviously, the minister will highlight, he established a task team, if you remember, that would look at the various guidelines that we need to put up so that people are looking at ideal models, looking at things that they shouldn't do, frequently asked questions, and as a sort of like a guide. But I think it's very beneficial to set up those templates, but obviously in discussion with the BEE Commission. You know, then the sale of shares, back to black hands, that's what we've been promoting all along, and that is what the policy was intended to do, that it was encouraged that black shareholders transfer the right back to black shareholders and not dilute further the ownership of black hands. You know, I take the important note of trustees and the so-called bad leavers. I anticipate many people will be questioning those, and I suspect those will be handled by the Commission, and that will be coming to that. But of keen interest is the key issue you raised around VW and the auto sector. That's a very important point you're mentioning. We would note, and we all know, and as far as our incentives and how we support the industry, we do expect a level of compliance on their part. And this has obviously raised concerns to them, considering the constraints and they face in terms of one, who's their supplier, who gives them the components, and the like, and the limited scope they have in their view right now to get through and through BE empowerment to the right level. What the department has said is that we will accept a level of compliance,
And that's the important thing. We're encouraging that they all become compliant. And the trend as it is now, they're all looking at about level 8 in general, including the VW. And we are saying, let's work out a plan on how you improve on that. And that does not compromise, as long as there's a plan in place and obviously a degree or a level of compliance, then we will consider, obviously, we'll continue to support the industry. But interestingly, we've received a number of brilliant case studies, talking about Ford, for example. You know, Ford has undergone, they've established about 5 years ago an incubator program. And, you know, we are starting to see the fruits of that incubator program now, where they have directly over 5 years, it has taken time to get a supplier for the Ford Ranger. They have three suppliers now that are black-owned, more than 51% black-owned, that have received purchase orders officially. Now, that should be highly applauded. And they have sort of like championed the cause on how to diversify their value chains. And Ford, for example, not actually speaking highly necessarily on them alone, there's many other initiatives, have also looked at a number of other projects that they were doing internally that they see there's opportunities to get black suppliers to further supply. So on the part of VW, they are really striving to do the same. And that's the trend we want to encourage. Where there's opportunities to localize, where there's opportunities to find the black supplier, let's invest in that supply. And there's a whole lot of initiatives we're doing. And we're linking it to the Black Industrialist Program. So us as government, we also want to put in what we can to help develop those suppliers from a CAPEX, from a logistics point of view. And we're working closely with the OEMs in achieving this. And this is also throughout the value chain. We're also looking at from a retail point of view all the way to the servicing part. We want to explore all the opportunities, and we're working closely with the OEMs in achieving this. Yes, the VW CEO has expressed concerns, but I think we're working with them closely to see what is possible and what can be done. Interestingly enough, if you look at the Mercedes-Benz situation, a large number of their suppliers are actually local suppliers. But the question is, are they transformed suppliers? And it's a question of working together with those suppliers, and we've had discussions with Arno, the current CEO, to look at and explore opportunities of just disseminating information and discussions with those existing suppliers to see what level of transformation they can achieve. But the OEMs understand that they trigger that process. And then I think the issue of verification, we can never overemphasize, and I think we are working on a number of issues to really remedy that. And I don't want to, obviously, I want the commissioner obviously to highlight on the issues of emerging trends and what she's highlighted, and I think those things are important. I think I'll leave it at that. I'll just be reminded if I missed out any important other.
Indeed.
Okay, Chair, Lisa, if you maybe you can, with your permission, Chair, if you can just talk to the issue of the sector codes, because the sector codes, at the moment, they are not within our control as the Commission. And for us, the fact that there's still uncertainty there impacts on our monitoring. So I would like Lisa to just address that so that there's some kind of a response towards that area. Thanks.
For that reminder,
I think that's a very important issue which perhaps some of us were not aware of.
Okay. Now, that's very critical. I think the important thing is that when we write legislation as per the codes of good practice, it's an attempt to look at what's generically aligned to the objectives of the policy and what is implementable. But then we recognize that within certain sectors, there's certain peculiarities that have to be factored in. The banking sector and how it's so highly regulated, you know, with Basel and the requirements in as far as ownership and all of that. You know, their very nature where certain sectors are more capital intensive as opposed to labor intensive. So we understood that, but the stance we've taken as a department is that we'll set the generic requirement. And then if the sector feels that there's a sufficient case and a motivation to consider the peculiarities of their industry, then they present a case. But then here's a couple of key important principles in doing so. We need to ensure that all role players and all stakeholders, from labor to business, and all stakeholders within that sector, participate in the process. And this is done through us engaging with them from day one. They set up their structure, they set up a committee, they set up a charter, they set up the process, and we come in from day one and start engaging them and guiding them on the process. But what then is allowed for them to do is to deviate, okay? And the deviation is accepted that it's a deviation up. Now, the deviation up is motivated by a number of issues that they feel as a sector they can do more. In the construction space, they feel strongly that setting a target of 25% is something they've achieved years ago. They would say they want to set a higher target to ensure that their sector sets an appropriate trend that speaks to current and existing circumstances. And so we allow for them to deviate, but what we do then, in that deviation, we need a motivation. They need to provide us empirical evidence why they want to deviate. And in instances, but the principle is always a higher target. So what we are faced with now is that now, in terms of aligning to the new codes, we're looking at one that is really outstanding. The others have all ideally submitted, and we are busy analyzing those very important points. So as to say, are they deviating with appropriate evidence? Is there a case for this? Are they setting unnecessarily high targets? And we are factoring all of those. But the important principle is that we allow them to deviate, but it must be evidence-based deviation. So in all instances, as we did with the first round, they are all have been walking that line. Now, there will be instances where there will be a deviation down, but we always say we need to compensate on another area. For example, in financial services, they say they would provide further access to funding, and because of regulations, they are unable to give too much in terms of ownership. All we're saying is that those deviations need to be motivated, they need to be consulted throughout the sector, and they need to be presented to us for evaluation. And the good thing now, we even have a commissioner that is going to be looking at those deviations as a further review of such, and that's critical. Yeah, okay.
Thank you very much. Do continue.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Pamela, is there anything that you want to respond to? Then I can just respond and conclude.
Thank you, Chair and honourable members. I think it's in relation to repetitive measures against preventive measures against people who continuously, contravene the Act. I think even in our presentation, we alluded on the issue of the blacklisting by National Treasury. You know, those can be actually removed from the database, and they are not going to be able to contract with government. Also, I think in relation to the trust and the modeling, I think it's the model as it stands. I mean, it's really not a good model that is used in particular on the employee share schemes, of which the commission is working very hard in terms of addressing those. Because, I mean, from the complaints that we have received, we've seen an increase in terms of the abuse in the trust and the employee share schemes. The lock-in clause that we see there, which are of an indication that it's only one party that dictates terms in terms of the contractual arrangement. They can terminate the scheme at any point in time, even prior to benefit having to accrue to the beneficiaries, And the issue around free loans, free shares in relation to free shares, of which workers get so confused because they do not understand. You are saying you're giving me free shares, but when the deal is not successful, you indicate that you have actually borrowed money in order to buy the shares. So, the commission is actually working on those issues. I think those are the few issues that I wanted to address. Thank you. I'll hand over to the commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to respond in sequence, but I'll just go through and try to address as much as possible. In terms of the role of the Chambers of Commerce, I must say that we have been receiving also requests for meetings from business associations. In general, we have had meetings. We were invited by Psyche, for instance, to discuss the BBB requirements and so forth. So we're seeing value in those sessions, because I think what it's doing is that we're beginning to see at least we're speaking the same language about what BBB is supposed to be. But we do want to say that we think that the role should be enhanced. I think we should see the Chamber of Commerce, taking this more strongly within their members, just to ensure that there is a level of compliance that is acceptable. And then we won't be able to, for instance, to speak to specific companies or entities. But I think what is going to be an opportunity for this committee is that with the amendments in 2013, now we will have reports that are submitted, all right? So from the JSE, for instance, effective from, because the first reports, the compliance reports, were supposed to come in for companies whose year end was ending on the 30th of June. They should have now started to report, the 30th of June, because the regulations were published on the 6th of June by the minister. So now, in Section 13G of the Act, there's a requirement for JSE-listed companies to submit their reports. So for the first time now, the state of BEE in South Africa will be able to measure it on reports that have been verified that are proper. Because what you've been seeing now, it was surveys, because people were like sending surveys to companies, how are you doing, and then companies then compile a report, then this is how it looks like. So for the first time now, with the implementation of these amendments, we're going to have concrete reports that the Commission will then, when we receive them, will analyze them. When we referred to 8 reports that we've already received, that is the beginning of that. So it's for the first time that that is happening. So since 2013, when the amendments were passed by this Parliament, nothing much happened, because after the amendments, then the department was working on revising the codes to align, so the codes only became effective in 2015. Listen, in 2015. So now it's only now that we're now going to start measuring, going forward, to say where this is where we were, and then this is where we're going. All right. So just in terms of that, I just wanted to make that clear that the role of the Commission only comes in now, but since the amendments, really nothing has happened. So we'll start measuring that. And in terms of the companies that are getting work and subcontracting to companies that are not necessarily compliant, this is another form of fronting that we've already picked up that is taking place. So the very same consequences that exist in the Act, they will exist for those as well. So when I was pointing the members to the definition of fronting in the Act, I think Parliament was deliberate in doing that. So fronting is anything that undermines the objectives of the Act. So if you are a middleman, there's a few women, if you're a middleman, and then you're just getting the work from government, then you're subcontracting to there are people that are just doing that. There are black people whose job is to actually just get the work from government and then subcontract it to somebody who's not compliant at the back. That is fronting. So even if that is a black person, it means that black person is fronting. So we will deal with it in the same way that we'll deal with it here. And that is why I was saying that actually that is the problem, where we're getting people that are actually willing frontiers, like people that are actually just actively doing that, which is undermining, because you can't expect that the commission should deal with you differently because of the color of your skin, but you're actually doing something that takes the objectives of the act backwards. So the same consequences will follow for those people that are, I must say, actually, Chair, there are some sectors that where this is so prevalent, it's become a practice. There are sectors where people are subcontracts, so you are a subcontractor for forever. So you never actually go up. And actually, when you see a person being happy about being a subcontractor for 20 years, there's something, you must already see that there's some indicators. For us, there's some fronting indicators. So we look at the sectors and we pick up the indicators, and then we then get deep into them. So at least our role now gives us an opportunity to say where we find those things, then we can intervene. In terms of the, if I go straight now to the sector codes, Liso has explained the process and all of that. We understand the process and we're happy with the process. However, what I would like to agree with Honorable Hill Lewis on is the abuse, because what we find is that the sector codes are not seeking to play around with the codes and work around the elements of the code. They are wanting to replace the act. That is what we're saying as the commission is unacceptable, and we will object to those sector codes that are doing that. For instance, it cannot be that this act says that this is a process for reporting, and a sector code brings another process. And it cannot be that where we're saying that from a compliance point of view, smaller enterprises are exempted so that you don't burden them with the cost. Then a sector code goes and says, no, in our sector, these are not exempted. Or we drop it to 1 million instead of 10 million. That is against, it goes, so you actually now interfering with the principles. You're creating another new dispensation. So we're saying that is not acceptable. Play around with the elements, or whether you're going to lift ownership or whatever, or whether you're going to bring in something else as opposed to that. Yes, they let them play around with that, but they can't fiddle with the framework. So when they fiddle with the framework, they create a new dispensation. It's going to be a nightmare for entities to comply or even us to monitor the activities in the sector. So with the sector codes, we're very clear that those sector codes that want to redo the act and they want to be parliamenting themselves, we will raise our objection to that very directly, because the parliament has already pronounced on these issues here, and they cannot in their own spaces want to recreate that. But we believe that the department, because it's the one that is all of these things come to the department for approval before the minister gazettes them. So the department must be able to do that, to make sure that those things do not find their ways there. We've already given our views to the department in terms of the things that we will object to if we find them in those codes, and then that has been made clear. Chair, in terms of just there's an issue around the ones empowered, always empowered. Again, I don't want us to dwell on the current case or the current issue. And I agree with you, Honorable Hinwil, that it's not only the transaction cost. It's not only that. There's a whole lot of issues. But the issue that should be at play is, for how long do you want to recognize somebody for something that they don't have? It is a fact. They had been their black partner. The black partner is no longer there. So should you recognize it forever? We're thinking that that is contrary to the objectives of this act. What are you recognizing? Why must you get a point that says, from an ownership perspective, you are at this level when actually there's no black ownership? I think for us, it's not really to try and counter the arguments, but to go to the objectives, because our role is to monitor and assist the implementation towards the achievement of this. So in the codes already, the transitional period has already been accommodated. Should we go beyond the 3 years that has already been accommodated with the continuing recognition principle? So I think that's where we need to say, at what point are we really going to achieve the level of equity where BEE, as this act, is no longer going to be necessary? Because this is a redress intervention. So if we're going to be allowing recognition of something that doesn't exist and create an illusion that there's some transformation when there's no transformation, At what point are we going to come to a point where this is not necessary anymore? Chair, when I was here for the first briefing in the committee, and I was talking about the approach that we have as this entity, it might change, maybe, as people come in, but our approach is that, and we've read everything that has got that led to this. Our approach is that this is a redress intervention. We must do it as quickly as possible to achieve the necessary level of equity such that going forward in South Africa, the grandchildren of everybody that is sitting around here is not going to be faced with these things where when they go to apply for a job, then they say, okay, preference will be given. We must achieve the level of equity so that this is not necessary anymore. So now the point I'm making is that if we recognize something that was there, let's say in the commission now, I've got a 50-50 in terms of women, males. And then the other 20% of my females, they leave. That I must be recognized even less next year that I was 50-50 last year. So I must be recognized forever that at some point I was 50-50. That's what this is saying. And we're saying that let's look at the principle. Is it advancing this? We don't think it's advancing this. So it's going to take us years and years. So BE is going to be there forever. Maybe I misunderstood the mandate, but my mandate was that we need to implement this. This is a redress intervention. Let's implement it as fast as possible and let's not create an illusion that transformation is there when it is not there. So if black partners leave, let's allow for a transitional period for the company to look at other options and avenues. But if they don't do that within that period, when that has passed, they can't get points for something that doesn't exist. That is our view on that. Chair, just in terms of the coordination with government, we've raised this specifically with the department, Liso and the team, because they've got a bigger role to play with the state entities. The exemptions that are required, they are submitted to the minister, so they don't come to us. So as the commission, we monitor them after that has happened. Our challenge now is that the departments and the state-owned entities are not getting those exemptions. So if they're not getting those exemptions, if they implement certain requirements that are contrary to the codes, then there's a technical non-compliance. So meaning that they are not complying. So how is it that government itself can expect anybody else to comply when government itself is not complying? So we're saying that we need to make sure, and it's not even about only compliance. The second thing is, companies that are fronting are not supposed to get business from government. Government is not implementing that as well. So there are no measures in place. So where companies actually were given a license in a particular industry on the basis that their black empowerment composition looks like this, once they get the license, and then when they have the license, it changes. The composition changes. The black partners suddenly exit, or they are being withdrawn, or they are being made to actually exit the company. The departments are not following through in terms of also compliance to make sure that where that was granted on the basis of the BEE, if that changes, then the license can actually be withdrawn, or at least there must be explanation. That monitoring is also not there. But further, the normal due diligence that you need to do when you are assessing a tender, just checking whether the company exists or doesn't exist. Those simple things, that needs to happen. So we're saying that let's get them on board, because if they're not on board, then BBB is not going to be implemented. It's not going to be implemented properly, because it is government largely that also needs to implement it properly. But Chair, we have done presentations to the cluster of DGs. We have sent the letters to the DGs. We're also actually comforted by the fact that letters that we've sent, we've seen them now taking effect in those departments, where in fact some of the DGs have already in fact written to all of their other entities to actually do implement and do those things and put together the processes to comply with the BBB Act. But Chair, I want to say also that because today again we didn't have the opportunity to take you through our strategy. What we think is, yes, there is a there's some mess there and there. But the mess was created by the lack of clarity in some instances, all right? So, and hence we're saying, like, for instance, the ownership schemes, there could be direction. A whole lot of companies want to do these schemes and they want to do them properly. So we want that clarity to come out as soon as possible. And we have been assured by the department that now there will be that direction. So as the commission, once that direction comes out, that model scheme, we're going to publish that so that when we assess the schemes, we assess them against something that also the people outside, they know how they should do it. So it's not something that is somewhere sitting there and then people get to be surprised that they're not doing it correctly. So it's part and parcel of our strategy. In our activity report, where we spoke about practice notes, where we spoke about the practice guides that we've issued on the third party procurement and all of that, that is part and parcel of the intervention. Where we see that there's disparity or people are confusing something or they're not doing it properly, we'll issue guidance on that. And then once we've issued guidance, everybody must then go according to that. And then we can deal with the outliers, the people that then deliberately do not want to do it the right way. But we do believe, Chair, that a whole lot of companies want to do it correctly. We get a lot of contact. We have a lot of queries. If you see the 136 written clarifications, is exactly on those types of issues where companies are saying, this is what we want to do, but we don't know how to do it, and we don't want to do it, and then you come back and you tell us it's not right. So that is also assisting. So we're inviting companies to come to us for that assistance, but we will issue the model as it were. Chair, I think let me close on that, but Honorable Nkonki, the issue around the black people that are fronting themselves is the same as the tokenism. And in these instances, we're thinking that the role of the commission now will also start empowering those people. Because what happens is that these are serious positions where you come in, but your job description suddenly is stripped. But for purpose of empowerment, you are counted as being there, but actually not there. And we're saying that for us, yes, we'll recognize the fact that you're transforming, but we'll then go to the depth of that. So if it's supposed to be counted under management control, which is one of the key elements as well here, then you have been recognized fully. Then that's where the verification process comes in. The verification process is supposed to check whether your job description matches what your level of decision making, whether that decision making you actually exercise it. At the moment, we find that companies will employ a black person at an executive level, but they don't have any decision making in relation to the company. So they are appointed on the sidelines of the company. So the verification process is supposed to pick up those issues. That is why our strategy is to strengthen as well the verification process so that it limits the opportunity for that kind of tokenism that is taking place. So we'll prevent that tokenism, we'll prevent the fronting of the black shareholders, we'll prevent some of these things at the level of verification, because that's where these things are supposed to be picked up. Yes, we'll intervene as the commission and we'll have preventative measures in place like guides and all of that. But at the end of the day, it's the verifier who issues the certificate that needs to make sure that when they say somebody's an executive and they're counted under management control, that they actually make the decisions in that company. At the moment, they don't. The last thing that I must just say, just in terms of the benefit to employees, is it employees, it's collective schemes like trade unions and all of that. I can tell you now that based on the complaints that we have, there is no benefit that is direct. So they're just employees, maybe they just increase the salary a little bit so that they're happy for a while, but they call it an ownership scheme. So that model that can be done will actually assist that those things are prevented going forward. And then that the ones that are currently existing, that we deal with them, if employees need to be paid for what they was due to them, then we need to order those payments. They must be paid in those instances. But it will depend again on our jurisdiction, because our jurisdiction is limited by the time within which the Act came into effect. Thanks.
Commissioner, thank you very, very much. We do need to come to the end of this, but I'm sure this won't be the closure. What I'm going to suggest, because there are two or three outstanding issues, including some in writing, we may wish to have back. Honourable Hill Lewis,
I'm going to ask you to have that put in writing so that we can get that information back. Honourable Mantash, the same would apply to you. And as chair, I also have a few issues we would like to have back. So, you know, I don't think we must leave it so long again. It's been a long, long time, but I think that was due to the constituency election period that has been so long. But there are a number of issues that we want to address urgently before we rise this year, Honourable, Commissioner.
Chair, I just want to say this, and just in all honesty again, that the trends that we're showing are not an indication that there are no good BEE initiatives. I just want to make that clear. We're seeing good initiatives that have come through our office, especially those companies that have come to us to say, can you help us and help us? We can already see that people are actually wanting to do them the right way. I think we need to encourage that good behavior. And because of the fact that there's been a gap for such a long time in BEE, there's too many people that are purporting themselves to be experts in BEE and are giving wrong advice. So we're now taking back, we're going back to basics. And because of the willingness of the other people to actually do it right, I think we can actually get a maximum impact in future. So that is why, Chair, our strategy is focused on compliance, where we're going to drive a whole lot of our efforts there and deal only on enforcement with the people that deliberately just don't want to do it. But I must acknowledge that point, Chair, that yes, we are saying these are the trends. They are shocking, but it doesn't mean that there are no good model BE deals that are taking place. Thank you, Chair.
That's very encouraging news, because I think that in a realistic application of this legislation, we should achieve the objective. But it's very encouraging to hear that there are businesses, you know, people in the private sector, enterprises, that recognize the value and wish to comply. But we must try and remove those who are giving the wrong advice and, as you put it, misleading business people. But thank you very much. We will be in written communication with you after this meeting so that you could come back to us the week of the, of the 1st of November, let me put it that way, the week of the 1st of November. If possible. We do thank you very much. For us, it's been an exciting development, and we appreciate that. What is also alarming, though, is the issues raised by the Honourable Hill Lewis around these codes, which, as you now confirm to us, doesn't fall in your area. And, you know, we may want to interrogate that further as well. The other issue is the issue around the, conscious flouting of the intentions of this act by creating almost bogus trusts, etc. So thank you very much, and thank you to all the members of your team who look as dedicated as you are. Thank you, Commissioner. Members, we've got just 3 minutes in out comfort break. Let's get back here within 5 minutes. Thank you. We're going to start with the BRRR. Thank you very much. Mr. Hermans, if we could just see you for a minute. Honourable Hill Lewis, could